Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Cooperative. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, Birmingham, Unity FM on 93.5 FM in the Midlands, and Radio Verulam in St Albans.
The theme this week is writing. Coming up on the show, later on we'll be hearing from John Jackson, the former sub-editor on the Daily Mirror. Our guests this week are Mark Jones, who's written a book on the history of the Bristol folk scene, and Kerry McLeod, who's the director and publisher of a local magazine called Bishopston Matters here in Bristol.
Malcolm Greaves reads a poem from the 17th century on writing, Nick Payne reads us the first instalment of his memoirs, and Tim Burrows drops in to read us one of his poems. Jeff Sparks is back, finally, in the studio for his What's On Guide and Song of the Week.
I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
But first, a song to start the show, and it has to be, of course, Paperback Writer by the Beatles.
Paperback Writer!
Our first guest this week is Mark Jones, and he's here to talk about the folk scene in the Southwest. Hello.
Hello.
Or should I say the folk scene as it was?
Yeah, the book that I wrote, Bristol Folk, is looking at the folk scene back in the 60s and 70s. Very much a golden era of folk in Bristol.
It's looking like I've got it in front of me right here. It looks like a formidably well-researched tome. I mean, how long does it take you to, from sort of thinking about it to getting to this stage?
About 25 years, actually. Seriously, though, when I actually finally thought, OK, it's going to be a book, about a year and a half from first sort of very, very dodgy writings to actually getting to a publishable sort of standard.
Okay.
And not getting laughed at when I published it.
Right, OK. So do you have a lot of time on your hands, therefore, I'm assuming? I mean, you don't have a...
Not necessarily. I think my day job would like to think not. But yeah. To be honest, no, this is sort of evenings, weekend type stuff.
Right. So how do you go about sort of writing this book? Do you write it first and then sort of look to get it published, or put the idea out?
Well, it actually started off as a set of listings, record label listings on a website. I was selling secondhand records for a few years, and it was basically meant to get traffic in, you know, discographies of record labels that were fairly sort of collectible on the collector scene. It sort of backfired in a way because people came and looked at the lists but didn't buy the records. But a few of the musicians actually looked at the website and got in touch to say that you ought to be writing about this. And it was one of those things that sort of mulled around in my head for about 3 years. And I finally put pen to paper and thought, here we go. But I thought I was writing a completely different book. I thought I was just going to be doing a record label discography.
Right.
But suddenly found out that I was getting so much information from the there was still a lot of these folkies on the scene in Bristol. In fact, I'm living sort of within about 400 yards of about 18 of them.
Right.
So I was getting sort of lots of stuff, and the anecdotes started taking over. So I thought, okay, let's actually try and write a book rather than a list of things.
So did you not really find very much like this, like the book that you've published? You know, when you sort of thought about writing this, presumably you must have looked to see if there are any books on the subject already.
Well, no, that was one of the things. There was a book about jazz in Bristol which I'd bought, and I was sort of thinking, wouldn't it be nice if there were sort of other genres covered?
Hmm.
And the reason it was the folk thing that got covered, it was just because I think that was probably I had a lot of folk records from Bristol artists.
Okay.
So
I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking folk is this is a sort of a history, therefore, of sort of bearded men in pleasant jumpers, singer songwriting.
If you look at the pictures, you'll see that you're completely right, actually.
But what sort of range does it cover from that stereotype?
Well, a lot of that singer songwriter stuff. Yes, they did wear paisley shirts and very dodgy jumpers, but. Again, you get the traditional side of things. The stereotype is the finger in the ear. Whether that's because they don't want to hear themselves either, I don't know. But moving right up to the sort of folk rock side of things as well. So bands like Stackridge, who are still going, or rather going again. It covers quite a lot of ground. And also, it's very difficult dealing in genres because there are people who sort of dip in and out of genre. So there's sort of a couple of people that might be considered jazzy or
some
whatever.
People might be more blues folk.
Well, the blues sort of fits in very well because the folk set were very influenced by American blues.
OK, so are you a Bristol lad yourself?
How long have you been in Bristol? Shirehampton, yes.
Shirehampton, excellent, right, not far. So what was your youth like? Was it a misspent youth?
Well, yes, probably.
Yeah. I'd be disappointed if you said that.
Yeah, I know. a lot of listening to records when I should have been doing other things, I think. And that, back in the dear old 60s, that was the R&B type things. So sort of Pretty Things, Rolling Stones, The Small Faces, those sort of things.
Mm.
And, yeah.
I mean, I suppose the main, fulcrum for a lot of stuff is obviously London. Did you check out London a lot when you were that age, and how did it sort of compare with Bristol?
When it came to writing the book, I didn't have to, because the London people came to Bristol, because it was basically the sort of second biggest folk scene in the country. If you were playing London, you were playing Bristol, and half of the people playing London and getting great sort of responses were the Bristol set.
Okay, that's very interesting, right. So how much sort of travel and legwork and all this sort of thing, I mean, where do you get all of this information from? Apart from, because obviously the artists themselves aren't necessarily going to have a complete record of their own stuff necessarily.
No, they don't. But there again, there's a thing called email, and it's amazing how many sort of 60-plus musicians are on email.
Yeah.
So an awful lot of the stuff was, I didn't really have to go to them. It was a case of finding out where they were, sort of virtually, and emailing them, and they were all very, very sort of keen to get involved. And the other good thing about having them email you is that you don't have to end up writing the stuff up yourself. You can do a lot of cutting and pasting.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what it's like getting your book finally published. I mean, what sort of deal do you get? How does it sort of work out?
Well, this is where I sort of cheated, to be honest. I got in touch with a fair few local publishers and some not-so-local publishers, and to be perfectly honest, they didn't seem that keen. Folk music is a bit of a niche market. Are we going to sell any?
Hmm.
Probably not. So I finally thought, OK, there's an old Peter Gabriel song called DIY, which sort of came to mind, and I thought, OK, if no one else wants to do it, I'll do it myself.
Right.
Which involved, of course, then learning how to become a publisher, how to use publishing software, how to get the thing to market, all these other things as well. And I'm sort of, I'm still not quite sure what I'm doing, but it seems to be going all right.
Well, that's very interesting, right. So you had to sort of create a sort of a company, I imagine, and go through all the legal hoop.
Yeah.
And then sort of find the printers. And so how many of these have you printed off? Limited run,
it's about 1,000 copies of Bristol Folk, and we're about halfway through, which isn't bad for a first time.
How long has it taken you to sell half of them?
Let's have a think. It's probably getting on for a year.
Okay, that's not bad. And where are they available?
Currently, they're available via my website,
yep.
Which is bristol-folk.co.uk.
Hmm.
Waterstones hopefully are reordering because they've sold out. But I'm not getting much response from that email. Bristol Museum are going to be, I think they've actually got stock at the moment, because the book's also been picked up on by the M Shed Museum, which is opening in 2011.
Okay.
And they've used the book as a resource for part of their creative Bristol.
And also
exhibition.
Understand we had Jan Ayres on in recent weeks, who's organising the Bristol Folk Festival. I understand you're probably hoping to get some of those on sale there.
It looks very much as though it's going to be adopted as sort of official merchandising. Basically, hopefully, this folk festival in Bristol is the new golden age. This is sort of celebrating the old
golden
age.
Do you think
age.
So? Do you check out the current scene much?
I find it quite confusing nowadays, finding what's going on. There seems to be a very sort of fragmented scene. There's a lot going on, and it's hard to really know sort of where things are going on unless you're actually that age group. I'm no longer of that age group, really.
Okay. Well, we'll pause for a second there. We'll play a track that's typical of the kind of music that we're talking about. I understand the artist who is in the next track has actually sort of written a bit in your book itself. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a chap called Ian A. Anderson. He had to put the A in so as not to be mistaken for the guy from Jethro Tull.
Right.
But he's now well known enough to be able to do without the A. He's actually nowadays editor of Eproots, the major folk magazine. So basically it's Ian A. Anderson, and the track is called Time is Ripe.
Welcome back to the interview. That was Time is Ripe by Ian A. Anderson, and he is in fact a contributor to this Bristol Folk Book as well. What other books do you do as well? I mean, I've also seen you brought along the famous Charisma discography for the uninitiated. The Charisma label was a record label, and the book is entitled The 40th Anniversary Celebration with forwards by Michael Palin and Chris Adams. What other books do you do? Have you got any?
That's again is back to the sort of discography side of things. I thought the Bristol Folk Book was going to be. There's another book coming out in about a month, which is looking at two specific Bristol labels, Say Disc and Village Thing. So again, very folky.
Ah, brilliant. Okay, well, if you want any more information on that, thank you very much to Mark Jones. Check out bristol-folk.co.uk. And I wish you the very best of luck and what a splendid effort. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've been peeking into the new game centre on Old Market cut and thrust games. But if fantasy games are not your thing, then the world of historical games may be. Decision Games in the United States welcomes freelance articles on historical battles. And to talk about this, I'm joined by Dalek's Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
So, how does one contribute to Decision Games in the United States?
The most important thing is to have a fascination, interest and enthusiasm for history and military history with this particular magazine. And I mean, we're talking about the games magazines here, but when you want to contribute to a magazine, it really doesn't matter what type of subject it is. You've just got to have some enthusiasm for it, and you've got to have the basic building blocks of research and writing skills.
Okay, so do they check up, you know, whether your research is actually any good or not?
Yes, they do. And also, you can contact magazines like this and see what games they've got coming up over the next couple of years, because there's usually a long lead time, and talk to the editor. Don't be afraid. Just phone them up and have a chat and say, well, you know, you're interested in such and such a subject. You've been researching it. And ask them if they're inviting contributions. You may find that they're not interested, but it's just as possible that it may be that they've got a game coming up in maybe 2 years' time, which is about a historical subject that you're very knowledgeable on.
Then they might be enacting, say, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, and you can get your chance to, you know, if that's your specialist subject or enthusiasm, to actually engage in that sort of...
That's right. And I mean, there's two stages to it. One is the actual historical research, which, you know, is a skill in itself, really. Mm-hmm. You can't just do internet surfing. You know, it means actually digging out some of the historical books and facts and figures about a particular era of history. And the second part of it is actually turning that into something which is easily digestible, readable article, maybe about 2,000 words, something like that.
Okay, so does it help if you have sort of credentials that can actually back you up?
It actually doesn't. It's one of those things that if the material itself is easy to read, it's fresh and it's good, fresh historical research, and that it's, you know, it's easy for people to digest, and it enthuses people, you know, because people buy a magazine about a specific battle because they're interested in all the history around it. So if you've got that information and you're able to put it down into, it doesn't matter if you have loads of credentials. If it's a good article, they'll use it.
Okay, so, and Decision Games in the United States, are they based in, I understand, Bakersfield, California?
I mean, obviously there's lots of other magazines. This is just one specific magazine about historical battles. But, yeah, I mean, the thing to do, obviously, is just contact them, speak to the editor, and see if they're interested in your contribution.
And once you've done your historical search, it will appear in Strategy and Tactics magazine. Well, let's find out what happens next.
Cummins, and I handle the production operations for Strategy and Tactics Press and actually for Decision Games. So I help make sure all of the production happens and oversee the office and the various people that work for us. Strategy and Tactics is a military history magazine that covers all of the eras in history. The feature story has a board game in it that lets you play out the story you've been reading about. Our current issue is the Allied forces at Dieppe in 1942. Previous to that, we covered the Battle of Shiloh, and we covered some Cold War battles from Kabul 1979 and a what-if was Wurzburg-Pentomic game. World at War features exclusively World War II, and the issue that's about to ship is Soft Underbelly, which features Italy 1943 and the landings there. Previous to that, we had a what-if game covering the Pearl Harbor invasion. That is, what if the Japanese forces had actually landed and invaded Pearl Harbor as opposed to just the air raid that happened.
How does a particular game go from just an idea into actually turning up in one of your magazines?
We get a lot of solicitations from a number of people that have game ideas, and then they shape it within the parameters of what we can actually print. And they work on that for probably 6 months and turn it in, and then we take another 6 months or more and work it through the process of making sure the game works and fits within our print parameters. And then we play test it, and eventually you guys see it in print.
What about current conflicts, things like Iraq and Afghanistan? Have you covered those?
No, not as much. We don't have as much in the current. Coming up in the summer this next year, we're going to have the 1982 Falklands War. That's our next modern topic in SMT.
But you see, that's quite a long time ago. I wonder if there's a bit of political sensitivity around some of the conflicts. For example, you've got the sort of Russian occupation of Afghanistan, but not the NATO occupation.
a lot of what we do is based on what our readership has feedbacked or sent in responses to us and asking for their preferences on what we produce, and it hasn't swayed as far over in the modern as that, but it is leaning that way currently. So I would expect to see more modern topics coming up over the next, probably in about 18 months. It takes a little while for us to work them into the system and get them out to production.
And I wonder if there is any people with actual real military expertise putting their time and effort into the developing these games.
There are. Some of the staff that works on these has military service or background, and then we use various writers or game designers themselves have also had military experience. If you have a real interest in history and want to understand how a battle is fought, using one of these games will really teach you that, because you get to see the topography of the battle on the map, and then you have the small cardboard game pieces that are the actual units involved that you get to move around and see how you would fight the battle and maybe make different choices than the commanders did. Some very popular ones were most recently would be Red Dragon Rising, which was on the Taiwan invasion. So that was a hypothetical, very popular topic. We send out 20 to 25,000 per month to get either magazine, Strategy and Tactics or World at War, overseas is $149 per year. And we have all that posted up on our website at strategyandtacticspress.com.
That was Callie Cummins, who is head of production at Strategy and Tactics, part of Decision Games in California. And you can find them on the web at strategyandtacticspress.com.
Our next feature is by Anthea Page. It's an interview with John Jackson about his life as a journalist, ending up as the sub-editor on the Daily Mirror. This week we're going to hear part one about John's early career as a journalist for a local paper in Tamworth.
Jackson.
John, tell us about your career in journalism. Where did you start?
Well, I started where most good journalists start, and that's on your local paper. And mine was 40 miles from Birmingham, called Tamworth, which is now virtually a sprawling part of Birmingham. And it was on the Tamworth Herald where you're piled in to do magistrates' courts, reporting on guys drunk in charge of horses, and as mundane as that sort of thing, and expected to fill a full column on that. You'd go to Soroptimist ladies' dinners, where all the ladies were gowned and jewelled, and you would be in your Burton's pinstripe suit, feeling very embarrassed reporting on the meal. But they were always very good to me, and it was a great training ground.
You said Burton suit. What year are we talking about?
In the 50s. Then from there, I matriculated to my first big job in Leicester on the Leicester Evening Mail, now defunct. In fact, a couple of places I've been, there's no papers after I left. But this was fascinating. And probably the most interesting thing of all was that there's a huge concert hall there called the De Montfort Hall, which is a stopping-off suburban place for many of the big stars. Probably two of my best interviews, and that was with someone a lot of you won't remember, but quite a few will, a guy called Liberace, who was one of the flamboyant entertainers of that time, with his smile and flashing key across the piano. And I spent 2 days with him and his brother doing an in-depth feature on him. And I still have the letter from Libby saying, "Dear John, thanks a lot. You did the most critical and balanced report I've ever had in England," which was jolly nice. I also did some that there were things like Lionel Hampton, who was a great, great big band leader, who refused to see me after the show. I thought, good heavens, I couldn't see a Leicester Evening Mail report after the show. So I started off my story, Hamp had the hump last night, and did a real nasty piece on him.
Tell us about Lisa Minnelli.
Oh, yes, Lisa Minnelli. Good heavens, it's when I was on the People, Sunday People in London, which was pretty big circulation in those days, and I was the sort of stand-in for the theatre critic. And among the shows that I went to see, one was at the Talk of the Town, which I don't know whether it's there now, but it was a big, big cabaret spot that all the stars took place. And this star, Lisa Minnelli, who wasn't terribly well known at the time. And I went along and they gave me a sort of ringside seat you had there, and it was quite spectacular. And Lisa Minnelli came on. And I thought, Judy Garland's daughter, you look a bit like her, you sound a bit like her, but you're never going to be as good as she is. And, of course, I did this quite critical thing. I was then banned by the Talk of the Town ever going back, and how hopelessly wrong I was, because she went on to be an even bigger star than her mum. But there you go. That was my opinion.
Tell us more about your career in London.
Well, my career in London was mainly on the People newspaper, where I was an investigative journalist doing crime. It was in the time of the Crays and the Richardsons. And I remember that there was one gang lot called the Nash Brothers, and Johnny Nash turned Queen's evidence, and Scotland Yard gave him the magnificent sum of £50 to leave the country, to get out of the way of the gangs. Well, of course, he soon spent that up and returned to England, we understood. And for some reason, we understood he was in Sheffield. So I was sent up from London to sort him out, which took a while, but I finally found him and persuaded him, look, the gang are going to get you sometimes. Why don't you spill the beans on some of their activities? So I brought him down from Sheffield by devious routes, brought him down to London, and then with a photographer, we'd go round Soho, and he'd walk up to a shop or a bar, and they'd say, "Hello, Johnny." And he'd say, "I'm Johnny Nash. Between October 24 and November so-and-so," giving the dates, "I took protection money racket from you." And I would jump forward and say, "I'm from the People. What have you got to say to that?" And it was rather a bumpy ride, I can tell you. But a good series came out of it. And the People, with their great investigators, journalists, did quite a lot. There was Bill Gardner, I think, was one of the top guys who did fantastic work. So it was quite exciting.
And then you joined The Guardian later on?
No, I was with The Guardian when I was on the Manchester Evening News. I went to the Manchester Evening News and Guardian. They were sister papers. On the Evening News, I was crime reporter for the Manchester Evening News and show business reporter and goodness knows what. In fact, I did a sort of in-town last night show business thing where I called at the Grand Hotel, and the under-managers would say, "We've got so-and-so staying with us, and a celebrity," and I'd go up to their rooms and interview them, and I'd go to another place. And that's where I met Jimmy Savile, and I claim to have made Jimmy Savile what he is, because he was the manager of the Mecca Ballroom. And I used to go into Jimmy, flamboyant Jimmy, who was smoking a cigar. But he had a great nose for news, and I'd always come out with a great story from Jimmy, and mentioned his name and Mecca Ballroom, and he got Mecca Gold Star, and was doing. In fact, one of the great ones that he told me about was a Polish girl. Her husband had lived in somehow was in Manchester. And she came over with an athletics team, and they had come in to Manchester docks because you could boats coming into Manchester there. And she skipped ship to be with her husband. And so they were together on the dance floor that night, and Jimmy Savile found them, you see, and I did the story. And I'll always remember the headline. They were poles apart, but not anymore. Last night they were together, dancing on the Mecca Florio. And I remember the editor came out the next morning and said, I'm giving you a working bonus job for that, £5. And I said, every day, sir. And he said, no, once a week. So that was good, and it was a great time. Yeah.
That was John Jackson there talking to Anthea Page about his days as a journalist, and you can hear part two next week when he talks about his experiences as a sub-editor of the Daily Mirror. A short poem now, read by Malcolm Greaves, about writing, and it was written in the 17th century in England.
An Author to Her Book by Anne Bradstreet. Thou ill-formed offspring of my feeble brain, who after birth didst by my side remain, till snatched from thence by friends less wise than true, who thee abroad exposed to public view, made thee in rags, halting to the press to trudge, where errors were not lessened, all may judge. At thy return my blushing was not small, my rambling brat, in print, should mother call. I cast thee by as one unfit for light, my visage was so irksome in my sight. Yet being mine own, at length affection would thy blemishes amend, if so I could. I washed thy face, but more defects I saw, and rubbing off a spot, still made a flaw. I stretched thy joints to make thee even feet, yet still thou runst more hobbling than is meet. In better dress to trim thee was my mind, but naught save homespun cloth in the house I find. In this array, amongst vulgars mayst thou roam. In critics' hands, beware thou dost not come, and take thy way where yet thou art not known. If for thy father asked, say, thou hadst none. And for thy mother, she, alas, is poor, which caused her thus to send thee out of door.
Well, thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves there. Time now for Nick Payne to read the first instalment of his life story, commissioned especially by us for us. It's entitled A Nomadic Tale, and he's agreed to write an episode for us every week. So, this week we hear about the pitfalls of organising a primitive music festival in West Yorkshire.
Yeah, I was invited to tell the story of my life, and I guess there are over 6 billion people on this planet, and they all have their own unique story. This one just happens to be mine. Entry into the world was quite a dramatic affair. On arrival, I was struggling to do the most important thing required for human life, breathe. It transpired that I had a cyst in my windpipe blocking the airflow, so I spent the next 18 months in and out of oxygen tents and hospital operations performed to help me breathe more naturally. This enforced separation from mother and family generated in me an inability to attach much importance to what happens to me in life. It has, I believe, also greatly contributed to my nomadic nature. I recently completed a year's graduate course in counselling at Abertay University in Dundee and came across John Bowlby's attachment theory, in which he states that separation from the mother at birth can produce a lifelong struggle to form attachments. I felt very relieved to finally have an insight into my sense of social detachment and reluctance to settle anywhere permanently. Having said all that, I spent an idyllic early childhood, climbing trees, riding bikes and lighting fires, not having to take anything too seriously. At the age of 11, my life took on a more challenging tone. I became aware that the world as we know it had been discovered and explored. What was left for me to explore? I bought my first pop record, King Creole by Elvis, found Radio Luxembourg on the dial, and occupied most of my evenings from then on. My mother descended into alcoholism following the death of her mother, and my father retreated into workaholism. I was dispatched as a day boy to a public stroke grammar school, some 2 hours' journey from home. It was run in the main by a bunch of psychopathic bullies, whose frequent form of communication, once verbal humiliation had proven an ineffective form of control, seemed to be to beat the living daylights out of you with a gym shoe. After struggling for many years with the grueling journey to and from school, from which I developed a lifelong attraction to hitchhiking, as this became the only way to get home, the buses being usually full up, and the subsequent lack of energy and enthusiasm for schoolwork, my life came to a crossroads. I fell in love with a girl called Anne who came from the wrong side of the tracks. She was working class. She introduced me to the lights of London and other such delights, and my waning interest in study evaporated. The headmaster finally suggested I might be more useful to myself and others by leaving academia and finding a job. I left, bruised, confused, bemused, and in no way prepared for life as a responsible citizen. Several attempts were made to get me to fly the nest and separate me from my girlfriend. One of these involved being sent to Germany aged 17 to perfect the language I had learned at school and to work in a cotton wool factory. I stayed with friends that we had met on holiday, and after 2 months, and much to the disappointment of my parents, who'd rather hoped I would stay and make a new life in Germany, I returned home to resume my love affair and to further humiliate my parents with my inability to fit into a normal social life. My restless spirit was proving too much for them to handle, and so I was deported 200 miles north, age 18, to earn my fortune as an export salesman in the carpet industry in West Yorkshire. The culture shock I experienced, being catapulted from the sanctimonious security of middle-class London suburbia into the harsh intensity of the industrial hubbub at its productive peak, was more than my gentle nature could stand. And I would frequently take to the bleak desolation of the Yorkshire moors in an attempt to find some solace and meaning to my existence. One place I found was a reservoir way up in the hills above Hebden Bridge called Withins Moor. My experience there sat in the lee of a giant boulder, breathing in the fresh air and watching sheep and wildlife go about their natural business, inspired in me a poem that was to become a prophetic blueprint for my own future take on power and status in life. It goes like this. The wind-scarred sheep live, love and die. You'll not find none but seldom. The barren heath and salty air are lifelong homes to ram and hare, but not to man who hardly dare step forth, and like a wolf in lair, he cowers in his kingdom. His realm consists of steel and glass, greed, power and complacence. Out there in howling wind of ice, wild life must fight or pay the price. A failure here cannot come twice, though sheep can ill afford man's vice of deathly self-indulgence. And yet if man could still return, forgetting all his kingdom, if he could come with peace of mind, without false values of mankind, if he could let himself unwind, he'd look around and surely find tranquility and freedom. In some ways, I was grateful for my exile in the industrial wasteland, apparently devoid of the softness and simplicity that I had experienced in my youth. It definitely toughened me up, and as I needed to create a whole new social scene, I had to develop some new capabilities. Not least of these was the discovery of my love for the theatre. My first introduction to the scenery dock backstage was a revelation and generated an excited anticipation of the magic that a live performance can bring, and that stays with me to this day. I spent some wonderful years there, and had my job not taken me away on frequent and extended visits abroad, I would have made much more of the opportunity. Even so, I became a major player in the Halifax Thespians, frequently being given the lead role. I can remember my first appearance on stage, and I had the very first words in the very first scene, and I was terrified. And I was standing backstage and trying to find some liquid in my mouth. It just wasn't working. And I turned back to Doug Turner, who was a sort of old veteran of 20 or 30 performances, to try and get some sort of reassurance. And I turned back to him, and he was white as a sheet. And I said, Doug, I can't feel my tongue. And he looked back at me and said, neither can I. It's the same every time, happens to me every time. So, I mean, that was my introduction to the theatre. But I overcame that and had a great time. At one point, when I was 19 and I was really enjoying my newly discovered talent, I wrote to John Neville at the Nottingham Rep. He offered me a place as assistant stage manager at £4 a week. I had just worked my way up from exactly that salary to the princely sum of £8 a week and couldn't quite muster up the nerve to start all over again in another new town. To some degree, I regret not having taken that opportunity. I dutifully dedicated 5.5 years traipsing around the carpet dealers of Europe, peddling my wares, and after a short stint living in Switzerland, where I lived the high life of an expat and enjoyed all of the several pleasures that wealth and opportunity presented, I was to experience a revelation that completely demolished my tenuous grasp on commercial ascendancy. In the hills overlooking Zurich Lake lived a bunch of exceedingly rich people. The area was known as Millionaire's Row, at a time when the term millionaire still meant exclusive affluence. I was invited to a party at one of these opulent residences. I felt that I'd finally made the grade and donned my most expensive threads to make the right impression. I was not disappointed. The house was luxury personified. Cocktail cabinets came out of the wall at the touch of a button. Hi-fi cabinets appeared out of the floor in a similar fashion. The pile of the carpet was so deep as to risk twisting an ankle should you move too quickly across it. My jaw dropped. This was surely the standard of living that my years of toiling at salesmanship had finally brought me to. I asked the host to show me the rest of his house. He said, "No, I've got something much more exciting I want to show you." He took me down to the bottom of the garden to a little wooden hut and an old scrubbed pine table and wooden benches. And he turned to me with a glowing light in his eyes and he said, "On a Saturday night, we put on raggedy clothes, come down here and have a really good time." I was devastated. My whole perception of the world imploded as I realised that once you could afford to buy anything you wanted, it seemed the only source of real enjoyment was to go back to the most basic values. I quickly reasoned that if that was the ultimate aim, then I could achieve that state without further toil and sweat on my behalf. And within 6 weeks, I had left the commercial world behind and joined the hippie trail.
And an extravagant thank you very much there to Nick Payne for reading the first installment of his life story, the first episode of many more to come. Let's look forward to it.
We have Tim Burrows here to read us his latest poem. Hey, Tim.
Hi. Yeah, this is called Traces. It goes in with the theme of the show this week. It's about writers leaving traces of their lives and their words. We leave traces of our lives in our words, footprints in the sand beside the river, slowly eroding with the passage of time, washed by the lapping tide. Their imprint fading on the page, ink losing colour to the light. Memory turning to sepia, fingerprints blurring into old type beside the cold trail of ink. Vestiges of past thought, reflections, things to say, clearing like the sky at the breaking of the day. Becoming history as the body ages, telling of the life's passage, a writer's words, sound on the stage of slowly turning pages.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, what a special occasion it is. After a long absence, he's back. He's dodged Hell's Angels and Outlaws to be with us here tonight. It's Jeff Box with the What's On Guide. Hello.
Hello, John. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Wednesday, 27th of October, Attack Attack will be performing with support from Freezy Atlantic, Go X and Clear the Coast at the Thekla in the Grove, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £7.50 in advance. On to Thursday, 28th of October, the Slide Blues Maverick, Dave Akari, will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Alan Clayson and the Argonauts. This group formed in 1976 and performed and released material until they split in 1986. In 2005, the compilation album Sunset on a Legend was released, and this prompted the band to reform. This is a track from that album, and it's titled Land Waster.
When the west wind wails across the west our way, and the raven wings down the Humber, fear stirs in the strongest hearts, the land becomes a harbour for Hardrada. The king must awaken, the house calls, the earldermen and earthlings have the winter.
That was Alan Clayson and the Argonauts with Land Waster from the album Sunset on the Legend. For more information, you can check out www.alanclayson.com. On to Friday, 29th of October, the Birdman Rallies will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Saturday, 30th of October, Gimme Shelter presents Tin Pan Gang with support from Call the Doctor, Camera Culture, and also Gore Police and the APBs. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Just a quick reminder to anybody who's interested in sort of alternative rock, metal-y sort of stuff, there's still time to get your tickets for Dillinger Escape Plan, who are playing on the 2nd of November. And for people who are so inclined to listen to that, you'll probably also like Winnebago Deal. They are performing at the Cooler on the 5th of November, and you can't get the tickets from the Bristol Ticket Shop. You have to go to their website to check that out. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Thank you very much to our studio guests, who were Mark Jones, Kerry McLeod, and, of course, Tim Burrows. Features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and Nick Payne read us the opening chapter of his own life story, A Nomadic Tale. The poem was read by Malcolm Greaves. Jess Sparks presented the What's On Guide. The studio engineer was Lee Duffield, with help from Mike Noyes, and the producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman.
And from me, Michaela Dennis. Have a good week.
To all of you, goodbye.
Back into